Welcome to the conference. Please note today's call is being recorded. Please stand by.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the call. This is Ashley Wilbon from the National Quality Forum. I'm one of the team members on the resource use project team here at NQF, and just want to welcome everyone and thank you all for coming. This call is the cardiovascular technical expert panel call. We have convened a subset of the standing committee members from the cardiovascular consensus development process standing committee to help us gather input, clinical input, on the measures that are going to be under review by the resource use standing committee that have been submitted by a couple developers within the cardiovascular topic area. So those of you that are on the call, we're going to do a roll call in just a second. I just wanted to just give a brief overview of what we're looking to do today and kind of how we expect the call to go, and maybe a couple housekeeping items as well. Because we open all the lines, if you're not speaking, just to kind of cut down on any echoes or anything that may happen, if you could just mute your phone when you're not speaking, I think that will cut down on a lot of background noise. Also, we are going to be using pretty much the format for the call in terms of the questions that you were asked to respond to in the survey for each of the measures. And we'll have up on the screen in the webinar, if you're logged into the webinar, you should be able to see documents. We'll screen share and bring up documents for easy reference in case you're not able to view them on your computer otherwise. So we'll try not to switch screens too frequently because we know that sometimes there's a lag in going, but we'll try to bring up any relevant documents that come up in the discussion. Right now, we don't have any slides per se on the screen, so you probably don't see anything of significance. Maybe just the measure evaluations. So if you're logged into the webinar, can you see the screen? Okay.
I can.
Okay, yes. Great. Just a quick overview of what we're looking to accomplish today. We had scheduled two-hour calls for this group of experts to convene and discuss the three measures that we ask you guys to review. We are hopeful that we'll be able to get through the review of all three measures in this call. If for some reason we aren't able to and we need to continue the discussion on any of the measures, we will use that two-hour slot that we reserve next week. But our hope is that we'll be able to get through everything today. So we'll be as efficient as we can to not have to use that call, but hopefully we can also get what we need. The input from this technical expert panel will be used and filtered to or passed on to our resource use standing committee. They also have the measures, and they are reviewing them as well, but many of the people on that resource use standing committee are not clinical experts, and really the sole purpose of this group as being experts in cardiovascular disease and cardiology and so forth is to provide that specific clinical expertise in the review of the components of the measure that are very specifically clinically related. There is a member from the Resource Use Standing Committee who is a cardiologist, and we've asked him to chair this panel. So he'll be helping us to guide the discussion today. That's Bill Weintraub. Are you on the phone, Bill? Okay, hopefully he'll be joining us.
I'm here.
Oh.
I had it on mute. Like you told me to do.
Oh, okay, great. Thanks. I'm glad you're there. But we'll be doing roll call and introductions briefly, but just wanted to let you know that as we go through getting input, Bill will be helping to guide the discussion for the group. And also, because he's also on the standing committee, when they meet and have discussions about these measures, if there's any input from the TEP that, the committee has questions about, we'll be looking to Bill to kind of help bridge that gap for those on the committee who don't have the clinical expertise and are looking to try to get that input that they may not have within themselves. So thank you again all for joining, and I'm going to hand it over to Anne Phillips, who's a member of our team, to do a quick roll call, and then we'll go ahead and jump in. Well, actually, as she calls the names, we'll ask you to do just a brief introduction on yourself so you guys can get an idea for who's on the phone, and we'll go from there.
William Weintraub.
Oh, yeah, I'm Bill Weintraub. I'm here. I'm chair of cardiology at Christiana Care in Delaware. My scientific background is as cardiovascular epidemiologist, and I've worked with large data sets, clinical trials, and I worked in cost-effectiveness analysis for decades.
Dana Al-Khatib, and you can correct me, please. Dana? No? Okay. Leslie Cho.
Hi, I'm Leslie Cho. I'm the section head for preventive cardiology at the Cleveland Clinic. I'm also an interventional cardiologist. I've served on NQF in the past in the cardiovascular steering committee, and this is my first time serving on the technical expert panel.
Thank you. Ted Gibbons.
Hi, Ted Gibbons, University of Washington, Harborview Medical School Medical Center, which is the public health hospital for Seattle, home of the Seahawks, I want to point out. Most of my interests have been in heart failure and also quality improvement. I had been before I joined the University of Washington faculty at Virginia Mason Medical Center, which is a large group practice here in Seattle. I've been on the Cardiovascular Steering Committee in the past in 2010-2011, and am very interested in participating in the technical evaluations that have been put forth.
Thank you, Ted. Judd Hollander?
Yeah, hi, I'm Judd Hollander. I am at the University of Pennsylvania as an emergency physician and clinical researcher. I mostly do cardiovascular diagnostics research, but also have some familiarity with the therapeutics area. Largely see myself as a clinical trialist, and I'm excited to be taking part in this. And I will congratulate you, Ted, even though I was rooting for Peyton. Because
well, I originally was, too, but I changed my mind at the first quarter.
You didn't even have to wait the first quarter, just the first play.
Right. It was impressive. Right. I just got to say that.
That's great.
Thomas Kotke.
Hi, Tom Kotke. I'm a cardiologist out here at Health Partners in the Twin Cities. I'm medical director for population health for the health plan, and most interest has been in both population-based intervention and also in organization of practice to improve outcomes.
Great. Thank you.
Sana, just in case she might have joined during the introduction. Sana Al-Khatib. Okay. Hopefully she'll join us during the course of the call. So I think we'll go ahead and get started.
And everybody can see the technical expert panel measure evaluation, the overall.
Yeah. So I think where we'd like to start is just kind of going through each of the questions that were asked of the panel to discuss, and kind of getting a summary of what the responses were, and let Bill kind of take the discussion from there.
Ashley, real quick, this is Sharon. I just wanted to see if there are any questions from the group on what we were trying to achieve today before we jump into the actual evaluation.
Great. Thanks, Sharon.
Yeah, so I guess I'll ask the question. Are we supposed to be giving general recommendations that the logic group is supposed to take into account in evaluating the specific points they evaluate for the measures? Is that the concept?
Well, I think we were having specific questions that we were asked, but I don't think we should feel entirely bound by that either.
Right.
So I think that as we have interesting and important things to say, we should feel free to say it. But we do have these specific questions we should address.
Okay.
Are we going to have some interaction with the measure developer before we give some kind of feedback to the standing committee?
That's actually a good question. Are any of the developers on the line?
Hey, Kim. I'm a general internist from Yale Core, and we developed the AMI heart failure 30-day AMI payment measure and heart failure measures. I'm on the line.
Okay, great. that's a great question because I forgot to prompt them to see if they were there, so thank you for that question. So to the extent that you guys do have questions, you're welcome to direct them to the developers on the phone.
Well, there's no problem to have the developers make a presentation, right?
We can certainly do that and provide them some time to give a brief overview. We hadn't prepared them to do that, but to the extent that they...
Had not prepared them.
We had not. I don't believe that we'd asked them to do that, but we can.
So let's to ask people on the, off the cuff to do that. We could ask them to... Would the committee prefer to hear a 5-minute introduction of the measures? Now we have the other one
from NCQA.
Is a developer available for that one as well? 1558. So there's no one from NCQA. We cannot have a presentation from them, of course.
I think we'll have to get feedback from them because I think the AMI and heart failure ones are extensions of the 30-day episode of care measures that were passed several years ago. The NCQA is a little bit more opaque, so I think we'll probably need to get some feedback from them or answers to some of these questions.
Yeah, having said on NQF panels previously, it is a good idea that I found to have a presentation of the measure. But this is a little different. This is a TEP as opposed to the committee.
Can you hear me?
So,
hello?
Hi. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, Ashley. It's Ben Hamlin from NCQA. I can't seem to be – I'm having trouble getting heard, I guess.
Oh, okay. Great.
Okay. Oh, maybe you were on mute. Yeah. Oh, that's great. Then you're here.
Yes, I'm here.
Well, so I think what I'm hearing, Ashley, is that the committee would, if the developers do not mind, the committee would like to hear brief presentations before we start the discussion.
That would be great. That would be great. If the developers are comfortable doing that, we'd welcome them to do so.
Sure. Fine with me.
Hi, it's Nancy Kim. Totally fine with me, but I will say that the guidance was that we should only speak if we're spoken to. That we received.
So, well, the question will be we're going to ask you for a brief presentation. So there you have
it. Happy to provide.
Okay, great. Okay. What I would advise people to do is you're going to find it a lot easier to look at the Word document rather than the webinar, which is what I have both open right now, but the Word document is much, much easier to read. So if everybody has that, you might prefer that to the webinar. All right. So, Ashley, are we ready to go ahead?
Sure. Whichever developer you'd like to go first, we can.
Right. Well, when we take them in order, as we see it in the document, then we have a lot of questions in only 2 hours, and so there's a lot of work to be done here to try and move through. But let's go ahead and have a presentation on 1558, Relative Resource Use for People with Cardiovascular Conditions from NCQA, about 5 minutes or so.
Okay. This is Ben Hamlin from NCQA. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. I think I was on a muted line or something earlier. So the 5-minute elevator speech on RRU for cardiovascular conditions is that we look at a general population with cardiovascular conditions, or more broadly, as we've defined in the past as IVD, ischemic vascular disease, a long list of things. We have used the HEDIS definitions for the eligible population, which I think some of your questions may address as far as, you know, some procedures in the year prior versus a diagnosis in either year. The measure itself looks at all resource use for during the measurement period for patients who have been identified with these conditions, so basically it's a total resource use measure. You know, we don't try and attribute the resources used to the condition itself. We just look at sort of broadly all resources used for these patients who've been identified. It is broken down into a number of subcategories, as you've all seen, I think, in the measure specification. And I think I'm actually just going to leave it at that.
Okay. So I think that we will have additional questions for you as we begin to move through. But why don't we begin from the very top, then, with the clinical logic I'm going to ask the committee to go ahead and speak up. So based on the stated intent of the measure, to what extent is the measured population clinically appropriate?
Can I go back 1 minute, just ask you?
Absolutely.
Judd, I'm guessing from your comment that this is available to us on the SharePoint site rather than looking at the webinar.
So I don't know if everybody's got it.
Yeah, because I can't find it.
Is the word come in or not? Ashley, do you know?
It is. If you go to, are you speaking about the actual measure or the summary of the TEP evaluation?
Summary of the TEP.
Okay. If you go to the main page, I'm not sure exactly where you are, but if you click on Committee Home in the left kind of blue bar.
Got it.
And if you scroll down to the meeting and call documents for today, under 2.3.14, you should see a Word document that's titled Technical Expert Panel Measure Evaluations.
Got it. Perfect.
Okay. Great.
Wait, can you say that one more time?
Sure. Are you on the SharePoint homepage for the committee? Yeah, if you click Committee Home and the left side blue bar on the side, scroll down to Meeting and Call Document under the call for today, 2.3.14. There'll be a Word document for technical. Okay. Uh-huh, sure.
Okay, is everybody ready? Or close to ready?
Yes.
So let's go ahead. All right. And again, based on the stated intent of the measure, to what extent is a measured population clinically appropriate?
I had a comment. This is Ted Gibbons. That seems to be fairly well confined to the patients with coronary disease, but doesn't include other manifestations of vascular disease. Is that the intent of the developer?
Can the developer comment, please?
I don't think it was necessarily intentional limitations. I think because it's a claims-based measure, we have been continuously refining the value sets we use, the codes to identify the population. And, you know, it has to pass a pretty high standard of reliability. And so I think that, you know, for the identification protocols, we try and use the ones that fairly reliably identify the population. And I've been looking at some of the specific comments and questions in here and trying to map those to our value sets to see if they're buried somewhere in the list of codes or not at this point in time. But unfortunately, it's about 100 pages, so I'm taking me a few minutes.
Sure, but specifically peripheral vascular disease, abdominal aneurysm, and non-surgical carotid disease, as well as ischemic cardiomyopathy, would be one that would lead to consumption of cardiovascular resources, but they're not listed in the measure that I can see.
Sure, and I would agree that those probably should be, you know, critical diagnosis that would be included, but they probably would be listed in the value set, not in the short list of EG diagnoses that would be included on the IVD characterization. That's a includes but not limited to.
Yeah. So as I understand the idea here, it is not to try and cover everything, even within a disease area, but really to have things that can be evaluated across institutions reasonably reliably. Is that correct?
For plan to plan comparisons, yes. That's exactly right.
So that some things are left out is not necessarily a problem.
No, it's not. But again, we want to be as inclusive as possible for the appropriate population. And as the coding has become more and more reliable, we do try and revise these as much as possible. If you have access to the clinical logic PDF that was submitted alongside the measure, you can see the comprehensive list of IVD diagnoses that are included starting around page 90 of that piece of paper. It really does cover a fairly broad range of anginas, cardiovascular conditions, including atherosclerosis and native artery atherosclerosis. Sorry, my tongue is not working very well today. and various occlusions of carotid arteries with and without infarct, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's a fairly comprehensive list, but it's all buried in the coding. We just to do that as a list in the measure would really kind of overwhelm, I think, the eligible population criteria.
So within that construct, and recognizing a certain limitation, are we reasonably confident then that this is a clinically appropriate population? All of us said so, basically, in the comments I'm looking at.
Right. I just want to add the caveat. As I went through these, there appeared to me to be, and this was probably just because it's my first time through it, I wasn't exactly sure where to put what comments. It seems like something that could have gone in one of these questions could have also gone in another, so I restricted it. So my feelings were that broadly the clinical logic made sense. I had some issues with some of the exclusions that will come up later.
All right, fair enough.
It's Leslie Cho. I just have a overview question. You know, my sense is this measure has been adopted by the steering committee in 2012, correct?
Yes, it is. Yes. It was endorsed in 2012.
Yes. So is the knowing the resource utilization, is there any data on outcomes that does the measure developers, now that the measure has been, or not, they've been working on these measures for a long time, is there any outcomes that they're willing to share?
I mean, besides what was in what was provided to us.
Right. I mean, the question is here's the, I understand the resources and I understand, you know, the cost or whatever, but all of these measures, I think my philosophical sort of issues are that I understand that one hospital uses $30,000, another hospital uses $10,000, but if the outcome of the patient is different between hospital A and hospital B, I'm not so sure I care about how much money they use. Do you know what I mean?
So yeah. So you're right if you don't look at clinical outcomes too.
Right.
You really need to look at both. Sort of, you know, the goal is the best outcomes at the lowest cost.
Correct.
Where you'd really like to be.
Right. So I guess the question is, now that the measure has been adopted, you know, for the last 2 years, are there any clinical outcomes associated with these measures?
So this has been, I have two things that I wanted to point out, I think, that I forgot to mention. First of all, we use standardized prices to define resource use for this, so we don't actually have exact dollar amounts between hospitals for these health plan measures. And the second is we don't actually get patient-level information for these measures. Despite the fact that there's about 75,000 data elements that come in, you know, for each of these measures from each plan every year to report this, none of that is patient-level. It's all aggregate by the plan. And so the only entity that would be able to actually look at the actual outcomes for specific patient populations would be the plan itself. We only report these measures with the HEDIS quality measures, so we have what we call a value equation. So it's quality against the resource use, so we can try and map, at least at the aggregate level in a plan-to-plan comparison, the value offered for that plan at the level of quality. Now, of course, that's firmly dependent upon the quality measures that are available, and right now we don't have any outcome measures that are currently available for this level of measurement. I hope in the future that will change. However, that's why we do not have outcome data. We do look at the correlations between specific service categories of the data submitted every year and various quality elements to try and, again, create some fairly high-level associations to certain plans that have certain high resource use in certain areas and why those might be, and why if that, you know, we don't judge, we don't say high resource use is bad, we just say it is because we calculate that every year. So I hope that answers your question.
No, that was very helpful. Thank you.
Hi, this is Ashley. I just wanted to clarify too, for our resource use measure evaluation efforts, it's something that we're working towards, but we don't yet require developers who submit resource use measures to link them with quality or outcome measures at this point in time. We do have another effort going on that's really exploring how best to do that from a technical aspect in terms of how you actually make, you know, those two signals, you know, how those two signals can be correlated into a measure. of some sort, either through reporting or a composite or somewhat, but we don't yet have that guidance, so that requirement hasn't yet been implemented. So for the purposes of the work we're doing now, we're really just kind of looking at the individual resource use measure on its own merits as it's submitted, and we just kind of do our best to with what the developers have and for what we're asking for at this point. So hopefully that helps.
Okay, so philosophically it certainly helps, but and we recognize it as a limitation. But meanwhile, we will plow ahead. So are we ready to move beyond question one? And we have 27 questions we're going to consider, team. 9 on each measure.
Fire away.
Okay, so next. To what extent are the definitions used to identify and measure population clinically consistent with the intent of the measure? So do they do what they say they're going to do? They're going to look at resource use for these particular populations. Have they actually done it?
Yeah, Tom Kotke here. I think they can. I think the questions that came up were whether every single diagnosis was listed in the measure or in the background material. And I think that's where the issue showed up here.
So the question then is, are the definitions too narrow, and are we actually prepared to tell a developer to go back and widen their definitions? It's a lot of work we'd be asking to do if we asked them to do that.
Well, my understanding is those codes may be actually part of the measure, even though they're not listed here. And so I guess the people who raise the question need to say yay or nay.
All right, so let's ask the developer to reflect on what you're hearing here. There's a worry that, again, we're hearing that the definitions may not be inclusive enough.
Yes, and we, like I said, I mentioned earlier, we annually update our value sets for inclusion in the measure population, and as we convert to ICD-10 this year, we've given them additional scrutiny because of the increased specificity. So we will be looking back from these suggestions to test whether they should in fact be included in what the appropriate coding would be. It's part of the value set process. We always appreciate the feedback, and we can certainly expand that population if deemed appropriate and the coding is tested to be consistent enough.
Okay.
It's difficult with such a broad category like cardiovascular conditions and ischemic vascular disease, because obviously there could be sort of like cancer, there can be thousands and thousands of codes. We just have to make sure that the ones we include in the measure are the ones that are actually being used by the plans, you know, in such a way that we can actually map to them and we can assign standard prices to them for their resource use as well.
So that may be as much as we can realistically ask, that rather than go back and say, start over, we don't like it, we can say, please consider going forward to be more inclusive if you realistically can be. Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah, Tom here.
We're very happy to do that.
Okay?
Yep.
Are we ready to go forward?
Yep.
Yes.
Is that a yes?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Evidence to support clinical logic described in S8.2. To what extent does the submission adequately describe the evidence that supports the decision logic for grouping claims to measure clinical condition for the episode?
Tom here, I think, you know, this issue about active cancer and HIV is that they're outliers, they're fairly rare, and they're exceptional. And so, I mean, I'm satisfied that those are out of there. Otherwise, I think they do a nice job, an adequate job. And plus, we have their attention about the other codes, and they're going to go to ICD-10 and take another look at what's appropriate.
Other comments?
Yeah, this is Judd. I had the comments about the active cancer and HIV in a subsequent question. You know, to me, most patients with active cancer have, you know, a reasonable life expectancy. It's obviously different from metastatic cancer. And HIV in this day and age is a little bit like diabetes in that it's really a chronic disease people do quite well with. So they didn't give me a really good reason for excluding those people in 2014, but it's probably a small piece of the set, and it probably doesn't change the reliability or validity. But I don't see a particular reason to exclude them.
All right. So I think we could ask the developer next, as they refine it again for the next time, to reconsider that.
Yeah, I mean, just for your information, that the principal reason for our exclusions in these measures is primarily around the amount of resources used for those conditions are disproportionate to the others, you know, for a patient who does not have either active cancer and a cardiovascular condition and or HIV and a cardiovascular condition. We cap out the resource use on a per patient level at $100,000, and obviously active cancer treatments can go well above that quite quickly. And so what you might see is a number of, if a plan has a large number of active cancer patients, their results will be capped out for that versus another plan who might not have that same population or have a different population. So it's more about the cost and not about the clinical component of whether active cancer is appropriate to conclude in the measure.
So the worry here is that you could have some clustering within institutions of high resource use measures, which could distort the ability to create a level playing field. Is that the idea?
Exactly.
And I think it makes
sense. That's a very good answer.
Yeah, I think that's great.
Okay, so then are we happy with this?
Very happy.
Wait.
Yes.
Yep.
All right, good. Okay. Next, given the condition being measured and the intent of the measure described, the alignment of the length of the episode, including what triggers the start and end with the clinical course of the condition.
Yes.
So remember that this is basically an annual resource use.
Yep.
Is this appropriate?
Yeah, I think if it's an annual resource use year, makes sense.
I think that makes sense. I think this was an easy one. Okay, next. Describe the clinical relevancy of the exclusions to narrowing the target population of the episode, condition, clinical course, or co-occurring condition, and measure intent. So here, this was sort of a little bit repetitive of what we discussed before. The comments, please.
I think we addressed a lot of this issue, you know, initially when we started talking about 8-1.
Yep.
I think it's appropriate, you know, now that I've heard the whole background from the measure developers.
I agree.
I think there was only one area, and I don't remember whether this was the section that I discussed it. I don't see the comments here. But I think there was a little concern when I looked at it that if you had, you know, step A, for example, you had a PCI, but then you ended up with a CABG, presumably during the same year, it only counted as a CABG. And I just wonder whether that, maybe I misunderstood it, but it seems to me that that wouldn't accurately capture the resources used unless it captured all the resources that were used.
Right. So the measure will, for a patient who has a PCI and a CABG during the measurement period, both of those would be included in the measurement in the aggregation of the resources used. They would also be listed independently under the frequency section for this measure, where we actually look at the number of PCIs, a number of CABGs, a number of carotids that the plan members had on a per member per year basis. So it would be included in both, I guess,
Okay, maybe I misunderstood that then. That makes sense.
So someone has a complicated PCI and then goes on to have a CABG, they're still included in both measures? In both categories?
Is
there a risk of double counting?
Not for the individual patient, no, because basically the plan has, you know, identified the patient in the eligible population if they have either of those in the year prior to the measurement period. But if they've had both of those in the year prior to the measurement period, they would not be included. Those procedures would not be priced as resources used during the actual measurement period itself. That's why during the measurement period itself, we only rely on the diagnosis criteria. But if that person did have a CABG and a PCI during the measurement period, maybe they had one, you know, in the previous year, you know, poor patient, and the measurement period, you know, then those would be included in the resources used.
Okay. More comments? We really sort of discussed this in some detail now. Okay. Do the exclusions represent a large number of patients? And I personally had trouble following whether they did or didn't. And maybe the developer can comment.
They currently do not represent the proportion of the plan populations, at least at our last analysis when we look at the plan-by-plan reporting.
So
but as I mentioned earlier, they do account for a disproportionate amount of resources used by a plan, but the actual number of patients on a PMPM basis is actually quite low.
You know what overall percentage?
I don't have it at the tip of my finger, no, because it varies by plan, and we have over 1,000 plans reporting this measure, at least we did last year, so. I could probably dig up that data and present it, but I'd have to go back and ask our analysis group to
pull it. It'd be interesting to know the distribution of that. Other comments?
Mm-mm.
Does everyone agree with my suggestion?
Yep.
That we should ask them to look at the distribution of a number of excluded patients?
Yeah, I think we're supposed to evaluate it. Evaluate it.
Yeah, we're asked to evaluate that, and we really can't. Okay, so there's a tough few, but not a difficult one after all. We're not asking you to do a reanalysis. Okay? All right, we've gone back to exclusions now. To what extent is the rationale for clinical exclusions adequately described and clinically relevant? We really discussed this in some detail.
Yeah.
Do we need more discussion on this, or are we willing to say this is appropriate?
So I only added in one thing to this, because we're supposed to look at resource utilization within the plans, and as an emergency physician who often takes care of patients that aren't paying, I noticed that if the plan opts not to pay for the service, it doesn't count, but yet it's still a plan member using a resource. And so without knowing how often plans or what percent of their payments or what percent of their resources they deny, it's really hard to see everybody's a level playing field. So my concern is that a plan could look better by refusing to pay for resources based on this measure. If I understand it correctly, that if you're just excluding all denials, I see that as a little bit of an issue.
But it seems to me that's a different issue than what's being asked here, which is really clinical exclusions. But I do see your point that you could have other reasons for a measure being so distorted.
So that issue is actually handled in a different arena. That's handled under our accreditation standards for each health plan. The services that are paid or denied and their processes for that. We don't actually address that in this specific measure, though.
Okay, I think if that's okay to the big group, just highlight that here, and I'm fine with moving on.
Yeah, I think it's probably I think it's a very important point, but a little bit beyond our scope. All right, next is, to what extent are the relevant conditions represented in the codes listed in the submission for clinical inclusions and exclusions? So we keep, these questions are very much overlapping, and I think there was concern here that we may not have all relevant conditions. But I think what our decision was, rather than ask them to start over again, that we ask them to reevaluate this on an ongoing basis. Other comments, please?
Yeah, I agree.
Very good.
All good.
All right, so that now we... We get into something a little more complicated here in our final one. To what extent are the covariates or factors included in the risk adjustment model clinically relevant and consistent with the measure intent? And here I'm going to ask the developer to discuss with us their risk adjustment methodology a little bit.
Okay. Well, so we use the risk groups from the CMS HCC hierarchical condition category risk adjustment process that we've basically taken a good proportion of that because that is a resource-driven risk adjustment method. We assign, I don't know if I can give you the reference page on the materials provided where it gives a brief description of the risk adjustment, but effectively what happens is all the diagnoses that appear on the patient's record during the measurement process give it a clinical category, then a hierarchical clinical category, and then it's an additional weights are applied for age and gender. That then assigns them to a specific risk group, a risk cohort, and we have 13 separate risk cohorts that are assigned for these measures, and that's based on the analysis that we did in the early days in the Optum research database to determine what the appropriate divisions of the risk cohorts are for plan-by-plan comparison. And so every person who ends up with multiple comorbids at a certain age and gender will end up in a risk group that's being compared to that same person or that same risk group in another plan. It's fairly extensive. Like I mentioned, it requires us to get about 75,000 data elements from each plan in order for us to be able to do both the expected calculations, but also to assign the risk cohorts for each of the patients.
So the idea is based on age, sex, and comorbidity, and what else is in the model?
It's a lot more than age, sex, and comorbidity. It's actually it's a hierarchical condition. So it takes each diagnosis that is apparent in the patient in the record, and assigns it a risk weight, and then it creates a hierarchy of those risk weights dependent upon the condition, the severity of the condition. Which then assigns it into a category. And like I said, I'm not having a good time trying to find the risk adjustment summary. So basically, you go through and you assign a patient a specific risk category based on all of their comorbidities. So it's not just yes or no, but it's actually every comorbidity that is apparent in the patient record is a factor in that what risk group they end up in. Because again, the HCC is a utilization-based risk adjustment. So it takes the diagnoses that are predictors of drivers of healthcare utilization. So that's what was oriented around. And we use the majority of the CMS HCCs in our risk adjustment. I don't know why we don't use all of them, but I think there's a specific reason. It's a very sensitive and very specific.
Oh, sorry. So if a patient comes in with redo bypass surgery, so it's their second bypass surgery, those patients are clearly at a higher risk, much more complex surgery, than people going for a first-time bypass surgery. So how are you guys able to risk adjust for that? Because there is no code for that, for redo bypass.
Right. So again, this is where one of the limitations is it's based in the claims. So it uses the claims code as a predictor for utilization and severity, and by taking everything over the entire measurement period to assign that patient to a risk group, so it would, the other factors, the procedure itself, additional diagnoses, if the previous procedure is during the measurement period, that will actually be captured and included as part of the risk adjustment stratification hierarchy. But again, the limitations are that it's a claims-based risk adjustment approach, and so it really is beholden a bit to the sensitivity of the claims codes available. But we do use the entire measurement period, the entire 12-month period, in assigning people to risk cohorts.
Right. So I understand this much better now that if you have to explain this than I did after reading about the measure. And claims are what they are. They're always going to have their limitations. If we buy it all into the use of claims, we've got those limitations that is built in. What are the metrics that you're using to look at how good the measure is?
We actually do an annual analysis of all data submitted to NCQA. All the RCA data that's submitted to NCQA every year. Initially, that was to look at the number of outliers that might have been present due to calculation errors. But again, given the complexity of the data that's actually pushed into us from the plans, we look for specific variation. We look for correlations between different service categories. We look at the RRU by risk cohort because when we report out, we actually unwind some of the risk adjustment by we actually report out. By age and gender and risk cohorts. So when NCQA calculates in-house and then puts it back to the plans, gives the males 44 to 56, or I don't remember what the cohort numbers are, in risk category 7 is what's compared to the other plan data from one of the other cohorts. So it's really very, it's a very discrete way to do it. We do a comprehensive analysis of any correlations we can see between either risk cohorts or certain service utilization categories, the quality measures, et cetera, et cetera. And we do this every year, and every year we find something slightly different. There's some medium correlations, there's some weak correlations, but really what we're trying to look for is consistency and reliability of the data submitted to us, principally.
So here, let me narrow the question here a little bit. If risk adjustment methodology, what statistical methods have you used to show us how good the measure is, how good the risk adjustment is?
Well, that's one of the reasons we use the CMS model, because CMS was the one who actually validated the risk adjustment approach for this type of reporting. So again, for resource use based risk adjustment, the HCC system is the one that CMS develops, CMS recommends, and CMS maintains. And there's a number of steps.
Fair enough. I understand what you did, but I'm still the question of what your own metrics were.
You mean why the decision to use HCC?
Did you use a R squared or what measures of how good a risk adjustment this is? How much of the variability?
We don't revalidate the risk adjustment itself. We do analysis, like I said, on the data coming in for reliability. Find that.
It's not actually the job of this TEP is a clinical TEP as opposed to a statistical evaluation, which will go on for this measure as well. I'm still a little bit worried that you're applying the measure and you're not revalidating it yourself. I will space here. I'd like to hear what the other members of the committee think.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, I had trouble, and quite frankly, it wasn't clear to me that we were really a clinical TEP, and so I was looking for some, reliability and validation, particularly for a measure that's already been in use and couldn't find it terribly well.
I couldn't find it either, and I was looking, and I was saying, like, am I completely lost here?
Right, and so that was my biggest criticism of this particular measure. If it's just how's the clinical stuff, well, then I have a very different opinion. But I think the issues you raised, I thought, the answers to the statistical modeling were generously, I considered, superficially addressed. I mean, it just wasn't clear exactly what was happening.
So, when NQF asked me to chair this panel, they knew that I wasn't going to stick to the questions. So I was going to ask people to speak broadly. So here's our opportunity. If we feel that they haven't done that, we should ask them. We should voice that.
So I'm comfortable voicing that. I guess I'm not sure that it's in our domain to review it, but I think certainly the logic committee is going to need it if that's one of the things they're going to be judged on.
I'll be representing the TEP at the steering committee, and it's on the clinical side they passed pretty well here, but I'm a little concerned about this. And yet it's addressable without them having to do reanalysis and restart over from scratch and redefine things. Just doing statistical validation is much easier. I'm prepared to say that at the steering committee if the TEP feels that way.
I would support that, Mrs. Judd.
Yeah, I think it would be reasonable to ask for this validation and explanation or a demonstration that this does, in fact, risk adjust in the extent to which it risk adjusts.
This is Ted. I guess I would go back to a more qualitative question rather than a statistical one, saying, If the measure developers just have to have given another elevator talk, what do they hope to accomplish by reporting these data, and what's their impression about the impact of these data without actually quantifying things in a more specific way? Do they feel that the institutions or the plans that have excess resource use are using it in one direction or another? Is it a geographic distribution, or
Wow. Everybody still there?
Hello?
Yep.
Did everybody hear that?
Yeah.
I don't know what that was. Is it an excess of PCIs, an excess of bypass surgery, and so forth? So it would be nice to have a paragraph summary of where we're headed with this measure. Is it really accomplishing what it's set out to do?
Yeah. So I think those are two really great thoughts, you know, that on the narrowness of the questions, I think that we would support the developers, but we do ask them both, what are you trying to accomplish here? And I felt that also when I read this, and there was this long list of the items, but I didn't feel like I came away with an overview of it.
Right. That's what I had the sense of.
Yeah.
Can I ask another question? Having looked at a number of hyperlinks, I was wondering about the resource utilization in tables, the data elements in table RCA 123, where it lists gender and age groups and the metric specification name. But it's not clear to me, and I'm asking the measure developer, why are inpatient, outpatient E&Ms included in the younger age groups, but based on the table, they don't seem to be in the Medicare age group or the over 65 age group? Is that just a misreading, or why is it?
That's a misreading of the table. The table actually, it's not supposed to be a table that uses the rows. It actually just lists in columns the different data elements that are required for the measure. So you have to report both male, female, the age cohorts, the 13 risk groups, as I mentioned, the type, whether it's a cost, okay, resource use, or a frequency count, and then the you know, specific component to which that falls under. It's not a great table, but...
That's why I asked the question. Great, thank you.
All right, more comments on our first measure. Do people need a brief break before we go on to the second measure?
No.
Let's
go ahead. Onward. Okay, so the next measure is Ashley, are you comfortable with where the discussion went on the first measure?
Yes, I think yes, I do. Tarun, any questions or comments at this point?
I know it might be challenging for some of the committee members to be focused just on the clinical logic, but as Bill sort of pointed out, it would be, you know, if there are other pressing issues that are more broad, feel free to note them, and we'll carry those forward for the larger committee deliberation.
Okay, very good. So no more comments on the first measure. We'll go on to the second one. We thank the developer very, very much. The second measure is 2431, hospital-level risk standardized payment associated with 30-day episode of care for acute myocardial infarction. This is developed by CMS with a contract to Yale, and we'll ask the developer for an overview up to 5 minutes.
Hi, it's Nancy Kim from Yale Corp. Excuse me. So as you mentioned, this is a hospital-level risk-standardized payment for a 30-day episode of care for AMI and also heart failure, and it measures payments made on behalf of Medicare beneficiaries. We'd like to point out that it's condition-specific, so we have one for AMI and one for heart failure. And I think to address the broader comment from the group about what this is really about, although it is a payment measure and it stands alone because it reveals transparency on the costs of care associated with both AMI and heart failure, two separate measures, it's really intended to be paired with our quality metrics, and in that vein, it's harmonized with the specifications of our 30-day of the CMS publicly reported AMI 30-day mortality measure, as well as the CMS publicly reported 30-day heart failure mortality measure. would you like more?
Feel any more detail, or should we go on to the discussion? We'll be coming back to you with questions, I'm sure.
Sure, of course.
Could I ask one question about that? Is it part of the intent in harmonizing it with the other 30-day AMI and heart failure measures to actually get some data about the sequence of use. For instance, we had quite a bit of discussion 3 years ago about bundling readmissions with ED visits and outpatient visits. Are we able to learn anything from the data you're acquiring here regarding cost as it relates to sequence and appropriateness of chronic care management?
The intention is actually to expose value and illuminate value by pairing both payments with quality. We do learn something about sequence because it is a 30-day episode of care, so you follow a patient from admission through discharge through their post-discharge services for up to 30 days post-admission. But the intention was really to try to illuminate value. Does that answer your question?
Sort of. But do you hope to gain some insight about quality of chronic or quality of care within 30 days based on early follow-up and avoiding ED visits and so forth?
We do hope to gain insights into the use of post-acute care settings, not necessarily specifically ED and observation, but all of that, SNF use, home health care use, readmissions, all of that that falls within that 30-day episode. So we do hope to gain some insights into post-acute care, but not specifically intended to focus on ED or observation.
I see. Since it's not patient-level data, you'll just be able to see the broad picture within a plan.
Correct. It's a hospital-level.
Hospital-level. It's not a plan.
Measure.
Yeah, it's not patient-level. It's an administrative database. Right. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, are we ready to go to the specific questions then? So most of these are also pretty straightforward, and then I think there's going to be some overview at the end. Based on the stated intent of the measure, to what extent is the measure population clinically appropriate?
I'm good here.
Yeah, I would think so. This one looks pretty straightforward. Yeah. Any problems with this?
Quite straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
No, none at all.
Okay, good. To what extent are the definitions used to identify the measure clinically consistent with the intent of the measure?
I think it's consistent.
I agree. I don't see any problems here. Any problems?
Yeah, no, I sort of raised the death and AMA thing in the text, but after going through the last measure, I think that's probably a small amount of patients, and I think it's fine.
What's the problem? The reason death's out is that they're cheap.
Yeah, no, I understand that. And I guess if it's just hospital-level data, it's not useful. And the AMAs are sort of a real quality measure, potentially. It may be
sure.
The people who roll through the door or maybe something you're doing that drive them away. But, again, I think in the big picture, it's probably fine to leave them out.
Okay. And that comes up here again also. To what extent does the submission adequately describe the evidence that supports the decision's logic for grouping claims, identifying the measure population exclusions to measure clinically the clinical condition for the episode?
I thought it was okay.
So the only thing that I had is a real issue. I in the absence of a better explanation, I found it unusual that costs were distributed the way they were. As I see it, for a 30-day measure, the majority of costs will probably be at the second hospital, not the first hospital, unless I'm wrong. You know, I live in the ED, but my world is if someone gets transferred, it's often out of the ED to the secondary, to the receiving hospital, and then the receiving hospital does all the expensive things and makes the 30-day plan for care. It would seem to me that if you want to charge costs to the transferring hospital, we probably should see a sensitivity analysis to say that's the right place for costs to be. But it's my guess that people spend a day or less at the hospital that ships the patient out, and then the remaining 30 days of their care are driven by the hospital that they get transferred to.
All right. So this is very important. Let me ask the developer to discuss the problems of patients that are sent from one hospital to the other and the decisions that have been made.
Sure. No, thank you so much. This is a great question. It came up a lot with our tech. So just to clarify, these transfers are from Hospital A inpatients. They're not from the ER, straight from the ER to the second hospital. It's really you're an inpatient to an inpatient. So you were admitted at that first hospital. So I hope that clarifies the ER issues.
Okay.
Secondly, when we deal with transfers, there's really only three ways to go. You can exclude them. If you didn't want to do that with AMI because about 8% of our cohort involved a transfer, you can attribute to the first hospital, as we are doing, or you can attribute to the second hospital, as you suggested also would be valid. We actually did a lot of sensitivity analyses, and it worked out that you think that the second hospital is the expensive hospital because they're doing PCIs, but it doesn't really change the nature of the hospital grade. I don't want to call it a grade, but the hospital profile. So we didn't want to exclude because there's too many, and we felt this is fair because Hospital A initiates that decision to transfer. There are obviously some, there's problems with attributing to A, but there are also problems attributing to B, and we thought on par. This is harmonized with the way that our mortality measure does it. When we did sensitivity analyses, A doesn't come out looking more expensive because they transferred.
Okay. I'm perfectly good with that.
Everybody comfortable with this?
Yep.
Yes.
All right.
This has come up in other measures, and it makes sense.
Right. Next is, given the condition being measured and the intent of the measure, describe the alignment of the length of the episode with the clinical course of the condition. So this is a 30-day measure that includes the initial hospitalization up to 30 days. Is this appropriate?
In the literature, there's been plenty of complaining about that 30-day period, but I still think it's appropriate.
So would people prefer that we use something else, a 60-day,
no.
90-day?
We don't have anything better. We don't have anything better, so I think 30 days is fine. It's just
you got to make it. The thing is, you got to make a decision.
Yeah.
So I think 30 days is fine.
Yep.
Yeah.
Everybody comfortable?
Sure.
Yeah.
It harmonizes. So if people are used to it, it's worth they have
right.
their
right.
If
people are used to it, it goes along with the clinical measure. Indeed. Okay, inclusion-exclusion criteria detail. Describe the clinical relevancy of the exclusions to narrowing the target population for the episode, condition, clinical course of co-occurring conditions and measure intent. Maybe we can ask the developer to discuss inclusion-exclusions a little bit and their thoughts.
Sure. I think you all had our technical report materials. We included basically any discharge that was an ICD-9 code for AMI or heart failure. I know we're discussing AMI right now.
Right.
And we excluded basically if we couldn't measure your 30-day episode of care. So I'm just going to turn to that section, or if you have it in front of you. So we excluded hospitalizations for patients without at least 30 days of post-admission enrollment and fee-for-service Medicare because we couldn't calculate the payment outcome. We excluded hospitalizations for patients admitted and discharged on the same day because we didn't really believe they suffered a significantly clinical AMI. It says transfers, but it's just the way we don't exclude transfers. They're already bundled into one inpatient episode, as we discussed, regarding the payment. So we don't really exclude transfers. It's written that way in the technical report, but I think that's really confusing, and we've since changed our language about that. We exclude for patients with claims that contain inconsistent or unknown vital status. So date of death precedes date of admission just because we think they're erroneous. We exclude hospitalizations for patients with claims that contain unreliable data. Similarly, if your age is greater than 115, we don't believe that that's true. We exclude hospitalizations for patients discharged against medical advice, because we don't believe that hospitals had a full opportunity to implement high-quality care. And I'm sorry, I just lost my page again. And we exclude patients who are transferred to federal hospitals because we don't have the data for these hospitals. We exclude patients with hospice enrollment within 1 year prior to or on the date of an index admission. This is done for our 30-day the standardized mortality rate for AMI, and also you may treat folks with a hospice enrollment differently than you would others. We exclude patients without a diagnosis-related group or DRG weight for their index hospitalization because we are not able to calculate a payment because we heavily rely on the DRG weight to calculate our inpatient payment. We exclude hospitalizations for patients with an index admission within 30 days of a previous index admission. It's really only for the one, this is really specific to admissions per patient per year. So if you cross years 2009 to 2010 or 2008 to 2009, this would apply. And lastly, for heart failure, we exclude those folks who have had an LVAD on the index admission or during their episode of care. And we exclude, for heart failure, we exclude patients who received a heart transplant during their episode of care. And we do that in those two sub-cohorts because we think they're really, really expensive and happen only in a few hospitals. And for AMI, we don't exclude either LVADs or transplants.
All right, so that was a very good explanation. Any comments? Anybody troubled by that?
No,
it
trouble.
All sounded very reasonable to me.
Yep.
All good to me.
Okay. So do the exclusions represent a large number of patients? And let's ask the developer again to comment on that.
No, they don't represent a large group of patients.
You know how many?
I can look on the technical report. So I'm looking for heart failure. Did you want to look for AMI or heart failure? Is it okay if I give you heart failure?
No, we can do those together just to make it more rapid.
For heart failure, I will just say it's incomplete administrative data is 1.29% of the cohort. And these are done at the same time, so these are not hierarchical. It's not 1.29 and then another percent. This is anybody who meets any of these criteria. Same or next day discharge and patient did not die or get transferred is 7.7%. Transfers into the hospital, again, are less than 1%. Inconsistent or unknown vital status is 0.01%. Unreliable data is 0%. AMA discharges are 0.4%. So these are all really small. Hospice is 1%. Transfers to federal hospitals is 0.03%. Missing DRG weight is 0.1%. I'm sorry, am I still there?
Yes.
Heart transplants are, for this is again for heart failure, heart transplants are 0.05%. LVADs are 0.04%. So it's very, very small. It's very similar for AMI. Although we don't exclude.
Was one of them that was larger? There was one of them that was 7% before?
Same or next day discharges and patients did not die or get transferred. Was 7% for heart failure.
All right. So is everybody comfortable with that?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. So to what extent are the rationale for clinical exclusions adequately described and clinically relevant? We've just heard all about that. Anybody troubled by what we've heard?
Nope.
You know, that, Tom here, just going back to that next day discharge, you know, we see a fair number of patients who genuinely do have heart failure who are brought in for diuresis and have a pretty brisk diuresis and are able to go home the next day. We even have some who in the ER where we diurese them in the ER and they go home. So, I mean, I don't want to sort of kick the tires too hard here, but I'm not positive that those aren't, true heart failure patients. They're usually chronic heart failure.
Good. I agree.
Do you consider that at Yale? What's your response?
Yale is considering that in the next round. So for measure evolution, for measure maintenance, what we call maintenance, for measure reevaluation, we are looking at that both for AMI and heart failure because even AMIs nowadays are kind of going home within one day sometimes too. So it's a very, very good clinical point. I'm
actually,
also
frequently these days with NSTEMI, they go home the next day. Amazing.
Yeah,
that's
STEMI.
Right. That's STEMI. Right. I will. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I just said we're sending home STEMIs 24 hours. They have normal LV function and they've got a stent in.
I know. It's very, very true. I will say we developed these data in 2008 and 2009. I don't think it was happening as frequently as then, but your point is a good one, and we are considering that for measure maintenance.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I had that down for the heart failure comments. I think it's really important for that because the landscape has changed since the time you evaluated this. Basically, you have to be what used to get in a unit to even get in the hospital these days.
It's very, very true. I will say that if
I think we have important issues here, whether we can recommend going ahead with the measure or do we feel that this is sufficient a problem that they should go back and redo the measure now, or is it okay to say, consider this in your next revision?
Yeah, let's do plan B there. Go ahead.
It seems to me that's too much to ask them to go and start over for this round. Does that sound reasonable?
Yes.
I'm okay with it.
I think it's heterogeneous, too. I think that heart failure centers are more like, and primary PCI centers are more likely to have a short length of stay, and other centers may be catching up. So it's probably the next round.
Yeah. But that actually suggests that there may be a systematic bias here with some institutions systematically sending people home earlier. And so those are going to be probably lower cost. And so you can bias against the institutions that send home a lot of people earlier. So there is a potential for something here that really throws off the measure.
Wouldn't that be a good way? It would decrease overall cost and presumably have the same quality.
No, sending people home decreases overall cost. That's not the point. The point is if you don't include them because they go home early, you throw off the measure and you may be biasing against hospitals that are working to send their patients home early.
Right, that's fair enough. Cost patients.
Yeah. So I think that one's worth bringing forward, that the full steering committee know that, but know that the plan is to look at that in the future.
Right. I also would like to just draw a distinction between the AMI measure and the heart failure measure. I mean, you know, I don't live upstairs in the unit, so in the OBS unit, we're not yet seeing, you know, STEMIs, but we are seeing the majority of the heart failure admissions, and many of them are going home relatively fast. So that may be something that's different now, more commonly than the short AMI visits. But
no, actually, I think short AMI visits for NSTEMI, not STEMI, for NSTEMI, the short visits are common.
Right.
Actually, as an interventionalist, I just want to say that for STEMIs, it's very common. If you have an uncomplicated STEMI at the Cleveland Clinic, we get you out of here in 48 hours or less, depending on how, you know, where the location of the STEMI was. Because now we do radial PCIs for 50% of our, STEMI PCIs. So it makes a big difference.
All right, but the measure is at 48 or 24 hours, the exclusion?
48, no?
48. Yeah, 48 is pretty long, actually.
Yeah,
48 is pretty long, both for STEMIs and heart failure today. I'm surprised it's only 7%.
It's older.
The data are older.
Yeah.
2008, 2009.
So this may be actually problematical going forward.
It is something we're going to reevaluate. I really appreciate your comments.
What's the time frame for that?
For the measure?
To reevaluate this?
Over the next year.
So I mean, that may be the most that we can ask of them, that we see a problem here, that it actually can create a bias, work against institutions that are sending a lot of patients home earlier, and that the data are a little bit historical and may have changed considerably in the last few years.
Yep.
Okay, are we ready to move on?
Yep.
Okay. So we're up to, they're all sort of the same here. To what extent is the rationale for clinical exclusions adequately described and clinically relevant? So I think we've really been over this, and we see the one particular problem.
Right.
Okay, next. To what extent are the relevant conditions represented in the codes listed in the submission for clinical inclusions and exclusions? All right, so we've already heard about this. We want more discussion about this?
No, I'm fine.
I think we're good. All right. Now, again, we move on to something a little more complicated here, and the last one. To what extent are the covariance factors included in the risk adjustment model clinically relevant and consistent with the measure intent? And here the variables used in the model were spelled out in very great detail. Maybe we could ask the developer to discuss their thoughts about risk adjustment here a little bit for us.
Sure. So we risk adjust, the way we risk adjust is other NQF publicly endorsed measures. It's a patient-level risk adjustment, so we take all the comorbidities that any patient with an AMI, let's just talk about AMI right now, had in the 12 months preceding their index admission or on their index admission, and we run bivariate analysis to see which ones are frequent and clinically significant with the outcome, which is our total payment. Because there are 15,000 ICD-9 codes, it becomes unwieldy. So we try to shrink these down with a clinical team of experts into about 189 what we call condition categories. So we run the bivariates. We choose the ones that seem reasonable. We exclude ones that don't matter, like pregnancy and things like that. It's not appropriate for Medicare population or AED or something like that. And then we run them through half of our development sample, so a random 50% split of our sample. We'll run through, see what's frequent and clinically significant, and we'll validate that with the other random half of our sample, and then we do temporal validation of the model as well.
Right, comments? Go ahead. I'm sorry. So, comments, please?
Yeah, Tom Cartier. Looks good to me, and I have a 220 patient, so I've got to sign off. We'll see you guys.
Okay, thank you for coming. So my problem with this is the looks like the methods of risk adjustment were very, very good, but the validation of it is really worrisome. For AMI, if I've got it right, your R-square was 0.05, and for heart failure is 0.03. So you're explaining very little of the variability by your risk adjustment. Is that correct?
That is correct. It is also on par with the level of risk adjustment we saw in a paper published a few years ago by Medicare using HCCs or hierarchical condition categories. And their risk adjustment only counted, it was a longer term, it wasn't a 30-day window, for about 8 to 12%, depending on the way they risk adjusted, of the variation they saw around payment. It doesn't work as well as for mortality and readmission, and we think that may be because a lot of the clinical decisions we make that affect payment may not be related to comorbidities. They may be related to physician behavior or other structural qualities of the hospital in which we practice.
I have a quick question. You know, like acute renal failure and whatnot mm-hmm. has been predictor over and over again, besides just dialysis, being on dialysis, of poor outcomes in AMI, you know, as well as all the mechanical complication of a STEMI and arrhythmia and cardiogenic shock. Am I just stupid? Because I can't seem to find that in the risk modeling.
Are you talking about AMI or heart failure?
For AMI.
It should be there.
I went through the statistical, and I looked through all this stuff, and like dialysis status is there, but, you know, having acute renal failure during the STEMI, that's not there. And things like, you know, just major mechanical complication of a STEMI, like, you know, VT, you know, it also like other things like AFib, but also mechanical complication like severe MR, VSD, all of these sort of complications are not there.
Great. That's a great point. It's because our risk adjustment is based on claims data, so they're not based on clinical data or your clinical course unit index admission unless that clinical course is reflected in claims data. So, for example, some complications that happen during index admission can increase your DRG weight, so that would make your index admission look more expensive. So if you had an ICU stay or you had some complication that was included in the claims, we would see that, but we wouldn't get down to the level that you're talking about. Hypotension or, as you're saying, AFib, unless that were coded and bumped you up in the DRG. So similarly, the creatinine of 1.4 wouldn't get coded unless somebody ticked it off. Does that answer your question?
I guess my thing is when your C statistics or whatever is 0.5 or 0.3 in heart failure cases, it makes me think that it's such a poor measure of risk adjustment that it might be unreliable.
Yeah, so here's the point. If you're only explaining 5% of variation with one measure and 3% with the other measure, and you're sort of attributing a lot to the rest of the hospital, how much is it realistic? What kind of risk adjustment would you say when you're doing a good enough job that a lot of what's left is related to the hospital? After all, you want to judge hospitals by this, but your risk adjustment, I mean, it sort of seems to me like a long climb for a short slide.
Yeah, you guys are making a great point. There are other things that we do believe could improve the risk adjustment. We haven't included them by design because we don't think that they are such as coming from a SNF or something like that. So it's sort of related to your comorbidity, sort of not. It sort of depends on where you live and all the resources around you. We haven't done that in the past because we believe it's sort of a structural quality of it's a health structure quality rather than a hospital, something we should adjust away from the hospital. But you guys are, you're raising a good point. Go ahead.
In my experience with cost models using clinical databases, you get your big bump ups for length of stay and for complications. But comorbidities generally don't add very much.
Yeah, and I would say I'm not surprised that you can't explain a lot of the variation because we're looking at clinical parameters that we know are important but don't necessarily drive changes in reimbursement. And so hence there should be a lot less variability than we would naturally expect, right? Because if you're not going to double the cost because somebody has papillary muscle rupture, then you're not going to be able to explain that variation even if they have papillary muscle rupture.
I agree with you. That's sort of the way I interpret this. This is because the DRG takes into account things like length of stay. This is a DRG payment system, so the index admissions are heavily based, they're completely based on the DRG weight. So unless that complication is going to bump you up in the DRG weight, you won't see that. I will also say it's a 30-day episode of care measure. It's not just the index admission, but we do know that the index admission is a high proportion of that 30-day episode of care total payment.
Right. So I just wanted to add, and you raised the SNF thing on your own, and I had missed, but I'd written it somewhere earlier. I think taking into account where a patient comes from is actually very important, and I think the socioeconomic status, since it's a hospital and not a patient-level measure, is probably important too. I think it's kind of unreasonable to expect an inner-city hospital with no resources and no public support to have the same quality measures as a private hospital of where everybody is insured and has a job. We can't get educational level, for the patients, but we can actually get zip code, SES of the hospital to give it a proxy measure. And I think that if you have a high percentage of people coming in from long-term care facilities, you're going to have entirely different outcomes because they're all going back to long-term care facilities, and that's going to drive up the post-discharge cost phenomenally.
Thank you for that comment. We don't routinely adjust for SES, gender, race, or ethnicity in our measures, mostly because we don't think that hospitals should be held to different standards based on the demographics of their patients. They shouldn't be making choices necessarily based on the SES. I will say we've also done some sub-analyses looking at hospitals with higher and lesser proportions of low SES patients by using dual eligibility as a proxy for low SES, and we really haven't found a substantial difference based on that.
Okay.
All right. So NQF also has policies on using socioeconomics and risk adjustment. Ashley, do you want to comment on that?
Maybe actually, Tarun might be a better.
Tarun, could you comment?
Absolutely. NQF's current position, there's actually an expert steering committee panel that is looking at this precise issue, and it's just met a few weeks ago. But as far as NQF's current criteria goes, adjusting for factor. We look for adjustments of factors that happen at the present, that are present at the start of care. And particularly, we're not looking for measure developers to make adjustments for socio-demographic and socioeconomic factors in the risk model, even though they may be predictive and increase the predictive nature of the risk adjustment model. However, this issue is certainly under evaluation at this point. But as NCHOA's current guidance stands, we don't look for those types of adjustments in order to facilitate understanding of differences of performance across groups and to ensure that we're not masking disparities of care. Again, this issue is under evaluation from an expert panel that's looking at the precise issue at this moment in time. But as far as this committee is concerned, we should sort of operate under the current NQF endorsement guidance on this particular issue.
So, now the other thing about this is this modeling does not include complications or length of stay, right? It only includes comorbidities and things present at baseline as a risk adjustment.
Correct. We don't include complications occurring during the hospitalization because they're not really comorbid.
Right.
Go ahead.
So it's a problem because those are the things that drive costs and that will drive up give you a much better R square. But on the other hand, it doesn't tell you anything about the hospital performance.
Correct.
If you include them.
Illuminate. Exactly.
So what you'd like to do is you'd like to start out at baseline and level the playing field. But the problem is that you don't know when your R-squares are this poor, you don't know that you've leveled the playing field or not. And how would you know?
By providing case mix adjustments, we feel like we've taken into account to the extent that we can, based on claims data, the hospital's case mix.
Yeah, it's the extent that you can, but is it good enough?
Is it
meaningful? Consistent. It's the best you can. I'm not saying, listen, you've done a great job in developing, and I think we'd all say that. But maybe it's an impossible task.
I will say it's on par with other folks who try to risk adjust cost and payments.
Yeah. So I agree. I've been there and done that. But I know that if you don't begin to include things in the hospital, that during the hospitalization, you don't get very far. And so I think that's what you're seeing. But the problem is that it may be in the par with what others have done, but I'm not sure that gives you a pass that we can say, okay, fine.
But we don't want to adjust for complications because it's
I understand that. I understand sort of the dilemma before you.
So can I suggest that maybe when this resource use measure is actually combined with a quality measure, the kinds of adjustments we're talking about will become more relevant?
I think it would be harder to do an outcome measure when the risk adjustment is so poor. And I think that, you know, for me, one of the things I worry about in measures like this is that, you know, these things will be, you know, disseminated, people will know or whatnot, and you have poor risk adjustment, so you have information without, no one's going to look at the R-square besides us. After we're done, that's it, maybe.
The steering committee beyond us will discuss this as well, you can be sure.
But us and the steering committee. But when these things get disseminated and people have this information without sort of the subtlety and the nuances of it, I fear that, you know, there'll be repercussions that, you know what I mean?
That's exactly right. There's danger in applying this if it can't be done well.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not saying that
this is not the fault of the developers. They've done the best job they could with this, I believe. I think they're...
Exactly. I think the Yale group does a phenomenal job with all the measures that they come up with. Maybe it's an impossible task, but at the same time, when something like this gets disseminated and people get sort of, you know, they get their hands on this and then without understanding all the subtleties, then bad things can happen, you know?
That's the basic idea. I mean, I think that on both of these measures, we can carry it forward that technically they've done a great job. They've done as well as they possibly could. But the problem with the measures is as we've just discussed, that there's this inherent limitation that you don't get very far in your risk adjustment on costs based on comorbidities.
Right, but I don't know that that's a problem. So I want to be the sort of contradictory view here. You know, it makes sense to me that if your costs are not directly aligned with your comorbidities, and they're not, that using the comorbidities to adjust for costs may not work.
Yep.
And I think it's a little, you know, apples and oranges. They're not directly related to each other. If every CBC I ordered was an extra $30, and then I was trying to look at who needs a CBC and who gets an extra $30, it would be different. But if I'm looking at what your comorbidities are, but you're still getting the same DRG, whether you have them or not, you're going to explain very little of the variability based on your comorbidities. I'm not sure I would expect.
You're right. It may not be a problem, but it's hard to know.
Right.
I mean, maybe 20% of the variability in costs is due to the hospitals, so you'd like an R-square that was really pretty strong. Or maybe 80% of the variability is variable in the hospitals, so the R-square based on this what we see here should be very weak. I don't know.
Yeah.
Nobody knows.
Right.
And there's no independent way of getting at that.
And since we've gone back and forth between the two measures, I'll just say that on my 10,000-foot view, when I looked at the spread in costs on the graph that was provided for the AMI measure, there was a pretty big spread. I actually was surprised at how narrow it was for the heart failure measure. So I think part of the difference is explaining the variability is maybe there's just way less variability.
Yeah, I think you can see that how that would happen, given the way resources are used for heart failure versus AMI.
Right. So, you know, I know that when you get to the committee, the first thing you look at is what's the importance of it, and if you're not seeing a big spread, then maybe it doesn't get past question number one, even though it's a high-yield area. I don't know. It's my first time through this.
That's an interesting point. Well, you know, I think that in terms of what our real charge, our core charge, I think that we can be very supportive of what I've done at Yale in both of these measures. But I do think I'm quite sure that this will come up about the limitations of risk adjustment will come up at the committee meeting. And if it isn't brought up by others, I will bring it up. But I'm about 100% sure that there's going to be quite a discussion about this. And I think the point is maybe we shouldn't worry about that so much. Also needs to be brought up. But I'm not. I don't know. I find it troubling.
Me too.
Because what you'd like to know is that you're reliably leveling the playing field. That's what you'd like to know. And we don't.
Well, any measure like this also has to have a message about how to interpret the data and how to improve. And if people aren't clear about what the message is, then it's difficult to create change.
Right. So, you know, I think that the developer probably could have done a better job in explaining some of those limitations. I mean, I knew to go right for it, I think it'd be a good idea to really try and bring that forward, what your own limitations are, in greater detail. Anything else? I think we've sort of covered heart failure and AMI together. I don't know if there's a reason to go through heart failure again now that we've gone through AMI, unless people want to.
I don't think we have to.
Yeah. Ashley and Tarun, anything else from an NQF's point of view that you would like us to cover today?
This is Ashley. It sounds like you guys have done a really thorough job. I'm just kind of looking through, just trying to make sure there wasn't anything. I know you guys kind of flipped between the AMI and the heart failure measure, but just wanted to make sure earlier on in the questions or concerns about the heart failure, the length of the heart failure episode. I think that's also 30 days. Some of the earlier questions, because I feel like you guys were going back and forth in the AMI, between the AMI and the heart failure measure a little bit later on in the questions. So I think as long as everyone feels like either your discussion would have been mutually relevant to the heart failure measure, I agree there's no need to go back, and you guys were extremely efficient with that. So thank you.
I think the same issue about the 48 hours applies equally for heart failure and AMI.
Yeah, this is Judd. I have one more issue with the heart failure one, in that, you know, the question about whether are there a lot of patients excluded. I believe the repeat visits exclusion was more than 20% of heart failure patients. And so that's a really large number.
All right. So can we ask the developer to comment on that, please?
I'm sorry,
you have 20% exclusions. Maybe you could go over the exclusions for the heart failure. You went over that for MI. Maybe ask you to go over that for heart failure as well.
Sure. I just have to pull that up, so bear with me. Can the commenter point me to the place where they saw that? I'm sorry. I don't want to waste everybody's time. I'm on the heart failure measure methodology exclusions. So we took all the total discharges for heart failure based on our ICD-9 classifications for 2008 and 2009 in the calendar year. We had about 996,000. We lost 1.23% for incomplete administrative data in the 30 days following in that submission. We lost about 7%, as mentioned, on the same or next day discharge. We included about less than 1% for transfer bundles. We lost 0.01% on inconsistent or unknown vital status. We lost 0% on unreliable data. We lost 0.4% on AMA discharges. We lost 1.3% on hospice characterization on the index day or the year prior. We lost 0.03% to transfers to federal hospitals. We lost 0.2% on missing DRG or DRG weight. And we excluded 0.05% on heart transplants. And we excluded 0.04% on LVAD. And both heart transplant and LVAD are on the index admission or during that episode of care.
I find the most troubling thing the 48 hours, which, again, you're going to go back and reevaluate in your next go-round.
Right, and I may have just missed it when you were reading the list, but did you comment again on the number that were excluded because they were readmitted?
Oh, I see what you're saying. You're saying, okay, this is, I think, your point. If somebody has more than one heart failure admission in the year, we randomly select one hospitalization per patient per year. So we did.
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about, the 20%?
I guess so.
Yeah. So that's where, because obviously most heart failure patients come back, we know 20% are readmitted within 30 days. We randomly select one per patient per year.
Yeah, I think that's a justifiable method.
Okay.
And that's consistent.
Otherwise,
with 30
days. You could use both of them, and you have to do an interclass correlation. Makes it pretty statistically a little bit trickier.
Okay.
So, I'm not troubled by that. So that's a little different. Okay. So again, I think our big problems are the 48 hours and the limitations of the risk modeling. Any other comments on anything, please, everybody?
Did we just get 2 hours?
Give it again. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. All yours, Ted.
I was going to say that as running the heart failure clinic in our public health hospital in Seattle, I would say that socioeconomic status plays such a huge role in managing these patients that it's something that needs to be addressed but it may not be easy to do so. Certainly, having avoidable readmissions in our patients is based on frequent visits and giving social support and paying attention to a whole lot of other things that have very little to do with the pathophysiology of their heart failure. But certainly, underserved populations tend to have very high readmission rates for heart failure, and that is not addressed. And it's probably as important for heart failure as any other issue that we're looking at.
I'm sure you're absolutely right. Again, that needs to be taken up at the level of NQF policy. I think they're going to come around on this.
So my question is, did Bill just do such a good job that we have 2 hours free next Wednesday?
I think so, actually. I was just looking at the calendar because I wanted to make sure I had the exact date of that call. Was that next Tuesday? To let you guys know. I think it was supposed to be on the 10th. No, sorry. On the
12th at 11, I believe.
Oh, yes, you're right, the 12th at 11. Thank you. Yes, I believe we are all set. If you guys think of anything, as long as everyone feels like they've got all their issues out on the call today, we're going to take the next few days to summarize your comments on the measures, and we'll be forwarding that on to the committee to kind of include in their preliminary evaluations of the measure. So I wanted to thank the developers for being on the call and for being so engaged and responding to the many questions that the TEP had, as well as to each of the TEP members for, you know, doing such a thorough review, and we really appreciate that. And I'm sure our resource use standing committee will find your input very helpful as well. And thanks to Bill for doing such a great job and getting us through on one call. Appreciate that.
Well, everybody's comments were just wonderful. I'd like to thank the developers in particular for the really hard, really excellent work, NQF for organizing this so well and facilitating everything as they always do. And really great, very important comments by everybody on the TEP.
Thank you. If you guys think of anything along the way, you can always email, you know, anyone from the team and just kind of send your, you know, plop your comments in an email, and we'll be sure to pass that forward. Otherwise, I think with the exception of Bill, who's on our resource use standing committee, I think the rest of you guys will be plowing forward on the review of the cardiovascular quality measures that are coming up over the next few weeks. So good luck in your efforts there, and thanks again for your participation. We really appreciate it. I do actually need to take 1 second before I forget to open up a public comment period. Operator, if there's anyone on the phone who would like to provide a comment to the TEP, can you prompt them now?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question or have a comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
Okay.
There are no public comments or questions.
Okay, great. Thank you. So I think that's everything. Thanks, folks, and have 2 hours of your life back next Wednesday. We'll send a follow-up email just to confirm that.
All right.
Terrific, everybody. Thanks for everything.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye.